Chapter 6. If Dobbs and Curtin had ever worked hard in their lives, they would have thought that what they were doing now was the hardest work anywhere in the world. For no employer would they have labored so grindingly as they did now for themselves. Each working day was as long as daylight would make it. Convicts in a chain gang in Florida or Georgia would have gone on hunger strike and not have minded the whippings either, had they had to work as these three men were doing to fill their own pockets. The field which they were exploring was embedded in a crater-like little valley on the top of high rocks. The altitude of the mountains and the low pressure of the atmosphere made work still harder than it would have been under better conditions. In daytime, the heat was scorching, and the nights were bitterly cold. There were none of the conveniences which even a working man in a civilized country, yes, even a soldier in the trenches, is used to and thinks he cannot live without. One should not forget that though the Sierra Madre is in fact a sister to the Rocky Mountains, it is in the tropics. There is no winter, no snow and ice, and consequently all plants, shrubs, insects, and animals keep alive all the time, and very much alive at that. There were mosquitoes biting day and night. The more you sweat, the more they like sucking your blood. There were tarantulas the size of a man's hand, and spiders the same size, not very pleasant to have for permanent neighbors. And then there was the real genuine pest, a little yellowish-reddish scorpion, the sting of which kills you within 15 hours. Gold has its price. Make no mistake as to that, and forget the stories and the blah of promoters who want to sell worthless ground at the price of cultivated orange groves in the Royal Valley.
Never have I dreamt that I would have to work like this.
Curtin growled one morning when Howard was shaking him by the collar to get him up from his cot.
Never mind.
The old man calmed him.
I've worked this way more than once in my life, and often for years. I'm still alive, and, what is more, still without a bank account to help me along for the rest of my life. Well, get up and make the burros carry the water up.
As the working field had no water, it had to be carried on burros' backs from a brook about 350 feet lower than the field. When, in the beginning, they had found that there was no water for washing the dirt, and that the water was so far down, it was proposed that the digging should be carried by the burros down to the brook to be washed there. After long deliberation, it was decided that it would be better to carry the water up to the field than to carry the dirt down. By digging out tanks and by using channels easily built from wood, the water, once carried up to the field, could be used over and over again before it evaporated. A wheel was constructed with empty tin cans and small wooden cases, and with the help of a burro, this could be made to draw the water from the tank, lift it with those cans and cases up to the upper tank, from where, on opening the shutter, it would run down the channels to wash the sand. Howard was an all-around expert. Whenever he came out with a useful idea, Dobbs and Curtin would ask themselves earnestly what they would have done in this wilderness without him. They could have met with a field rich with 50 ounces to the ton of raw dirt and not have known what to do with it, how to get it out, or how to keep alive until time to carry it home. Howard even burned lime out of the rocks, mixed it with sand and clay, and built a tank that would lose not a drop of water, except what evaporated. With the same stuff and other combinations, he tightened the wooden channels and the basins, so that here, too, no water was wasted. The men had breakfast long before sunrise to start work as early as possible. Often they could not work during the noon hours, as the terrific heat made their heads hum and their limbs ache.
Another reason why I prefer carrying the water up to carrying the dirt down is this,
Howard explained.
We can hide the whole field so well that it's almost impossible for any sniper to find us. If we wash the dirt down at the brook, a native hunter might see us and get suspicious. On the other hand, if he meets one of us with the burros carrying the water up, it'll be clear that the water is meant for the camp, for cooking, washing, and cleaning the hides. We'll start tomorrow to fence in the field and make it invisible. What do you say, kiddies?
Right, Daddy.
Curtin answered. Dobbs growled, okay by me. You know best, old rooster. One day during the hot noon hours, when Dobbs and Curtin were resting on their cots and complaining of the heat and of the work, Howard, sitting on a box cutting spikes for some new invention of his, watched his two partners rolling around about on their cots.
Hell and devil,
he said.
I often ask myself what you two thought it means, digging for the metal. You must have figured out you just walked along, and if you come near those old hills yonder, you just pick up the gold that lies around like lost grain on a wheat field after the harvest. You put it in sacks, take it along for that purpose, carry it to town, sell it, and there's another millionaire ready for the movies. You ought to know that if you could find the stuff so easily and get it home like a truckload of timber on a paved highway, it wouldn't be worth any more than plain sand.
Dobbs was turning on his cot. All right, you win. It's hard, very hard. But what I mean to say is, I think there must be spots in the world where it is found richer and still richer, where it would not be necessary to slave like the devil to get it.
Such spots do exist,
the old man affirmed.
I've seen places where you could cut it out from the veins with your pocket knife, and I've seen places, too, where you could pick up the nuggets like nuts under a walnut tree in the fall. I've seen fellows making 30, 40, 60 ounces a day, and I've seen, at exactly the same place and only a week afterwards, fellows getting mad over not finding even a grain. There's something strange about the metal. The surest way to make a good day's pay is what we do here. That is, wash dirt, which carries a certain percentage of the real stuff. That usually lasts for quite some time. I mean, it won't give out so soon and leaves you at the end of the day a fairly good earning. On the other hand, take these rich veins with nuggets lying about. They sure make the first guy that steps upon it rich and in a short time. But even that is very rare. All those who come later are losers. And what I tell you is based on more than 40 years of experience. Well, I should say it's a rather slow way of getting rich. Right you are, Curdy. It is a slow way. If you can stick it for 5 years, you may get in the neighborhood of $100,000. But I haven't yet seen a guy who could hold on for 5 years. Main trouble is, the field runs out sooner than one usually expects, so there's nothing left but to go out again and try to find a virgin field. This way it goes. You may have made 10,000 in one spot, you can't be satisfied with it, you believe in your good luck, and you go out again and again until the last nickel of the 10,000 is spent just trying to find another load somewhere in the world.
The outlook was anything but rosy. Dobbs and Curtin could see that. Suppose that after a year they should have made a pile. It would have been harder earned than money made in a contract with Pat. Blisters on their hands came and went, came again and dried up again, washing and rinsing, catching the sand up, and washing it over and over again. This alone would have been work enough. But before it could be washed, it had to be dug out. This could not be done as in a sand mine. The ground was rocky. Shrubs held on in the soil so that the rock had to be broken to lay open the earth. Rocks had to be crushed into washable sand. Water had to be hauled, and still more water, especially in very hot days when it evaporated rapidly. There was no Sunday, no day for rest. Their backs ached so much after a day's work they could not stand, nor sit, nor lie down comfortably. They could hardly straighten their fingers, they had become so stiff and knotty. Neither did they shave nor take time to cut their hair. They were too tired for such doings, and, still worse, they had become utterly indifferent to their appearance. If their shirts or pants were torn or ripped, they never mended them more than was absolutely necessary to hold them together. If for some reason one or the other had a few hours to spare, he could not make use of them on his own personal good. He had to go hunting to get a wild turkey or an antelope, or explore the surroundings to find better pastures for the burros, or go to the nearest Indian village down in the valley to buy eggs, lard, salt, corn, coffee, tobacco, brown sugar, flour, bacon, baking powder, white sugar, good soap, canned milk, tea, and such luxuries could be had only if one made a whole day's trip to a little town far down the western slope of the Sierra. Even there, these things were seldom to be had. There were no buyers for such rarities, so the grocers only occasionally carried them. If the fellow that went to get provisions brought back with him a bottle of tequila or habanero, this meant a banquet in the camp and a great day in their dreary life. Occasionally the question was brought up as to legalizing their claim and obtaining the license necessary to mine there. It did not cost a fortune, but the government was very particular about this permit and stood ready to collect its legal share of the profits. It was not because the fellows wanted to cheat the government of its taxes that they were reluctant to have the claim registered. Many other considerations caused them to avoid letting the government know what was going on. The government as such was honest and trustworthy in every respect, but who could guarantee the honesty of the petty officials, of the chief of police in the nearest town, the little mayor of the nearest village, of the general of the nearest military post? Who was to vouch for the character of the clerk in the government's office? On filing the claim with the authorities, the exact location of the field had to be given. The three men were of little consequence. Even the American ambassador could give little protection should it happen that they got into trouble. It happened in this country that chiefs of police, mayors of towns, congressmen, and even generals were implicated in cases of kidnapping, for ransom, and in open banditry. The government, both state and federal, could at any time confiscate not only the whole field, but every ounce of gold the men had mined with so much labor and pain. While the three miners were at work, they would be well guarded. Only when on their way back with their hard-earned loads would they be waylaid or hijacked by a party of fake bandits, acting under orders from someone who was paid by the people to protect the country from bandits. Things like that have happened even in the country to the north. Why not here? It is the influence of the atmosphere of the continent. The three partners knew both sides, and knew them well. Now their battle was only with nature. Once they had their claim registered, there was every possibility of facing a long fight with more dangerous foes. Apart from the taxes paid to the government, they might have to pay all sorts of racketeers, or as they called them here, coyotes, and so reach port again with but a small percentage of the profit left in their pockets. There was still another danger, which might be most serious of all. A great mining company in good standing with the government or certain officials might receive word of the filing of the claim. How long would these three miserable proletarians last after the great company started to bring before the courts claims of prior rights to this field, which some native puppet ready to swear away the blue sky for 100 pesos?
Here you see for yourselves, provided you have brains to think with, that much as we want to, we can't afford to be honest with the government.
Howard finished up his explanation.
I certainly don't like to cheat anybody out of a just share in my profits, not even a government. If we was on British territory, I wouldn't hesitate a minute to do what's right by the law. In this case, we have no alternative. Not alone our earnings, but our life and health depend upon forgetting about the license. Are you guys agreed upon that?
We are, and no mistake.
Right. Of course, you understand that if we're found out, it'll mean confiscation of all we've made, of all we have here, and very likely a year in jail. I think we can take this chance, don't you?
Curtin asked Dobbs. Sure we take it. Not for a minute did I expect that any one of us would be silly enough to propose any other course. So the question of the license was settled. If you have a license, you are not protected at all against bandits or racketeers. If nobody knows what you have a better chance of safety. The bush is so wide and the Sierra is so great and lonely that you disappear, and nobody knows where you are or what has befallen you. The discussion about the registration of their claim brought comprehension of their changed standing in life. With every ounce more of gold possessed by them, they left the proletarian class and neared that of the property holders, the well-to-do middle class. So far, they had never had anything of value to protect against thieves. Since they now owned certain riches, their worries about how to protect them had started. The world no longer looked to them as it had a few weeks ago. They had become members of the minority of mankind. Those who up to this time had been considered by them as their proletarian brethren were now enemies against whom they had to protect themselves. As long as they had owned nothing of value, they had been slaves of their hungry bellies, slaves to those who had the means to fill their bellies. All this was changed now. They had reached the first step by which man becomes the slave of his property.